You know, this seminar is a very important a seminar in the context of what is currently happening in South Africa, the challenges with COVID and so on and so forth. They require us to be innovative when it comes to service delivery. You know, Alexis is going to talk to us about water innovations in South Africa, in particular discussing issues around the challenges as well as opportunities that we are facing as a country or in terms of the innovations in the area of water. So, you know, on one hand, we are all aware, or most of us are aware, that South Africa is indeed a leader when it comes to research and innovation in the area of water. And we have developed as a country a number of innovations and a number of water-related technologies. But what is a challenge is that while South Africa is the leader in that area, the challenges around access to water and access to sanitation remain. Because what seems to be an issue is that we have been unable to translate or at least to diffuse some of these innovations so that they can address the key challenges that our people, in particular rural areas, but also in informal settlements and other marginalized contexts, so that they can also benefit from some of these water-related technologies. And Alexis is going to talk to us now about some of these, some of his insights based on the research that he has been doing, and also the research that has been done by a number of our colleagues in the HSRC in relation to some of the opportunities and challenges, as I've already alluded to, with regards to the adoption and diffusion of these water innovations. So we, without taking much of your time, I'm going to allow Alexis to go through his presentation. And most of us probably know who Alexis is, but Alexis is a research specialist, a senior research specialist at the Human Sciences Research Council. And he is also an incoming professor or associate professor at the University of Johannesburg. And he has done a lot of work in, you know, in the spheres of innovation and technologies. He is indeed the right person to talk to us about some of the insights that he has with regards to how do we then bridge the gap between the technologies that we have and the challenges that are also in the area of service delivery, particularly with regards to water access. Over to you, Alexis.
Thank you very much for your kind introduction, Skolomile. I'm just going to start with what motivated me to do this study. It actually emanated from two previous projects that I was conducting that brought me to Northern Cape and Limpopo. So when I was visiting those areas, there was one particular thing that struck my eyes, that was the contrast between the irrigated land and non-irrigated land. When we were trying to analyze the possibility that was available to rural communities in Limpopo to be able to produce the feed crops for an intended agro-processing project, we realized that water was really a big constraint. And then it just struck my mind that there is plenty of land, but there is no water on that land. So one of the biggest challenges of this country, the land scarcity and the concentration of land, or at least of fertile land among commercial farmers at the expense of a large majority of people who do not have access to land, is pretty much related to water. That was my first inspiration. And then there was this constant problem of acid mine drainage that had threatened to pollute the country. You know, all of you know that South Africa is a big mining country. But one of the problems of mining is when the mining activities cease, the country is left with all types of problems that can really threaten the environment. And acid mine drainage was one of them, and its problem is still unresolved. So then came a group of friends of mine who were editing a special issue on water innovation in Africa. So they approached me to conduct a project on water innovation. And I was very keen to go from those observations that I had, and then I undertook this study. And to my biggest astonishment, I realized that South Africa, being a very water scarce country, had developed a leading capacity to conduct research and find very, very innovative solution to water related problems. But in contrast to the leading capacity to develop and bring about innovations, the diffusion of those innovations was still wanting. And we know from the innovation literature that much more than generating innovation, what really brings the benefit is the possibility of those innovations to diffuse and to spread in the communities and bring about those benefits. So once the generation of innovation has been realized, it does not necessarily mean that people are going to benefit from that. It's only when it can really diffuse. And on that area of diffusion, the performance has not been as great as on the level of generating those innovation through research and development, but also just through the creativity. So now I tried to develop a framework for understanding the reason for that contrast between, on the one hand, that high capability of generating innovation, and on the other hand, the lacking diffusion for some of the technologies. A few of them have been able to diffuse, but a large majority of those innovations are still waiting for the constraint to be tackled so that they can also spread the benefits to the communities. So as you see, this is approximately the structure of my presentation. I'm going to present you the analytical framework that I use with the five theoretical criteria that I took from the literature from, I combined the criteria in Everett Rogers, 1995, and those from Bronwyn Hart and Kahn in 2003. And then I added the technology readiness levels framework of Munkins 1995. And from that framework, I try to understand why those apparently very beneficial and very advantageous innovations were not diffusing at the rate that would be expected based on the expected benefits and advantages. So once we have presented the findings, then we will have time to discuss the results, and then we also have time to challenge the methodology or the findings or whatever. and then go to the recommendations that are based on the findings that they have found. Okay. The threat of water shortage. So it's not just about the mining problem and the land scarcity problem. The water scarcity in South Africa is such that if nothing is done to really increase the water supply, or at least to reduce the wastage and to manage the consumption, the country is likely to fall short of the required water supply by 2025. It's in just 5 years. It's not a long period of time. The reason being that the population growth is going to generate an increasing demand on water, but the infrastructure that is used to abstract water from the ground resources, most of it dates back from the pre-94 period, so it's very aging. Most of water distributed through the network, it just gets lost because of the aging infrastructure. And if no drastic measures are undertaken, we run the risk of getting into water shortage. I do not want to remind you of the threat of water shortage in Cape Town, most of us remember. And just imagine what it would be if the whole country was expecting a kind of day zero. So the need for water innovation is really a crucial one because of the looming shortage. And with what we know about the climate change, everything can be exacerbated in just a short period of time. So for us, this is the precipitation map of South Africa. And as you can see, the western half of the country is really, really water scarce, and only the eastern half we have some kind of acceptable level of precipitation. So this problem is also a very serious one, as the distribution of water is uneven over the country, which means that for most part, there's what is called the interbasin transfer of water. For some region to have access to water, they have to import it from other regions. And this also demands a lot of organization to have water coming from the area where it is in abundance to areas where it is scarce. So I'm not going to repeat all of this that we have said about the success in generating innovation. Just suffices to say that the government has invested a lot of resources in generating those innovations, especially through the Water Research Commission. And this gives a measure of the amounts of financial resources that the Water Research Commission has been spending to support water-related innovation projects. And these are some of the examples of innovations that have been produced. I just want to stress here that initially when I started with this research project, I got hold of a Water Research Commission report called the South African Water Innovation Story, which reports on the most significant water innovation successes. So it has 17 cases, and one of the most significant water innovation was the so-called Hippo Roller, which is a very frugal way of transporting water in rural areas from the river to the households. It has been a very significant innovation because it relieved many rural households from the strain of carrying buckets of water on their heads. But on a second analysis, I have had to remove it from my analysis because it dates back to 1993. So it has actually been quite a while. It has been around for quite a while. So I later on tried to focus on the innovations of the last 10 to 12 years. Now, for my analysis, I first wanted to present the water innovation value chain, just to show that any type of innovation that can be developed at any of the stages of water innovation or of the water value chain can have significant influence on balancing the supply and demand for water. So water innovation can take place at any of those stages, but because of the cyclical nature of the value chain, any innovation of any kind, including innovation in connex fields that are not necessarily part of the water innovation value chain, like agriculture and mining that use water but that are not really part of the water cycle itself. Any innovation in those domains can have an influence on balancing the water supply and the water demand. So these are the examples of activities in the water value chain where innovation can take place. Later on, I will show in a table the type of opportunities and challenges at different levels of the water value chain that can contribute to improving this balance between demand and supply. Maybe just worth mentioning is this last one, the wastewater collection treatment works. Sometimes we tend to neglect that part, but especially here in South Africa, with respect to this acid mine drainage, this is just not just a huge challenge, but also a very big opportunity, as we will see from one of the technologies that have been developed to deal with this type of problem. So this is an overview again of the water innovation value, the water value chain, and the innovation challenges and opportunities that can be explored at any of those stages. I don't think we have time to go through all of these details, but just to give you an idea. So we will circulate the presentation so that those who are interested can go and check all the details. Okay. So there are challenges and opportunities in the exploration, abstraction, and treatment and storage of water, in the purification and the distribution of water, in the storage, in consumption, in terms of devices that can help consumers reduce the consumption, wastewater collection and treatment and reuse, very important. So in a scarce country, it's very, very important the ability of water to be reused, because the water resources are very limited in South Africa. So reuse is key to keeping the balance affordable. These are some of the innovations that I'm going to explore. So I'm going to focus on 10 innovations selected from this Water Research Commission report, as I mentioned before. With a specific emphasis on this number 6, for instance, it has been a very specific design that can help reduce the consumption of fresh water. In many places, not just in South Africa, you know that fresh water actually takes the biggest portion of water use in households. So any innovation that can reduce the consumption of fresh water is really, really very significant. And another one that I would like to dwell on is this eutectic freeze crystallization, because it's one of the innovations with the potential to really tackle the long-term consequences of acid mine drainage. Now, I have already mentioned this theory of innovation and readiness. What is usually neglected is that most diffusions become slower than what people would expect once they have seen the benefits of an innovation. And Rosenberg and Rogers actually explained that by the fact that the people who are in charge of pushing the innovation to spread among the potential adopters, sometimes they become complacent, because when they see that the benefits are so obvious, they think that everybody will run to get this those new innovations. But the reality is totally different. So there is a lot of effort that is needed to push people to adopt innovations, even when those innovations are obviously advantageous with respect to the technologies that they supersede. Another point is the lack of adequate information regarding the use of the innovation. Sometimes the system of incentives from the government can discourage people from adopting those innovations. But most importantly, the individual decision to adopt is based on a series of microeconomic factors, as explained by Rogers and Hall and Kahn. And I'm going to use specifically those microeconomic factors as the criteria to understand why the innovation of the innovations in the water sectors have not been adopted at a speed that would be expected based on the demand for water and based on the obvious advantages that those innovations can be expected to spread to the population. So what are those five factors? I'm going to explain them one by one later, but the five factors, the first one is the advantage of the new technologies or new innovations with respect to existing ones and available alternatives. The second one is the compatibility of those innovations with existing resources and capacities, but also with existing values and experiences and needs of the potential adopters. The next one is the complexity of the innovations. So whether they can be easily understood, whether they are easy to handle, and whether people can master them and use them without having to invest in years of training. Another criterion is the trialability. So the opportunity that people may have to try the innovation and see how it works before making the final call to purchase the innovation. And related to that is the issue of observability. So if trialability is not available, some people would like to observe the innovation working where it has been adopted so that they can have enough trust that if they purchase the innovation, it's going to work the same way as they have seen it in action. And next to that, there are those technology readiness levels. So the criteria for adoption are valid when the technology is fully developed. But before the technology is fully developed, it goes through different stages, starting from the first observation of the underlying scientific principle until the full deployment and validation of the complete technological system so that it can be deployed. These are the different stages that the maturation goes through before reaching the level of full deployment. Okay, so these are the technologies that I have included in my sample. And based on the observations that we have made and the research, I have classified them into different levels of technology readiness and then identified the main constraints to their diffusion. Now I'm going to the findings. When we look at this Vulamans, Amadrum, and Safe Water Africa, these are technologies that are mainly dealing with point of use, water sourcing and purification, especially in rural areas. These are technologies that have hardly any viable alternative to compare with. The thing that comes closest is maybe bringing piped water to those remote areas, but this is prohibitively costly. So on the point of comparing the advantage with respect to existing alternatives, they are the solution, maybe the only solution available to the rural area residents to access safe water. Because most of the time, the studies show that in some provinces, up to 7% of rural households do not have access to safe water. It's hardly imaginable, but this is the case. So for those people who really want are exposed to unsafe water, having this type of innovation is the only alternative, and it's when the technology is proven efficient, it is on the scale of being advantages, there's hardly any discussion. The second one, the wave energy reverse osmosis for desalination, it is a big advantage because it wants to use the cheap renewable energy that can be used for desalination. But the wave energy can also be used to generate hydropower that can be applied to other forms of water innovation, or just to serve in the regular electricity grid. AquaTrip is a very ingenious device that helps detect and save wastage of water. So it really has also a very big advantage, not just on saving on water use, but also on the cost of water treatment, because the water that you save, you don't use, is not going to the to the installations for used water, so it won't need to be treated. Double advantage. I have mentioned this Arumlu, which is based on a very ingenious design. So it's a kind of no-brainer. Somebody actually observed a shape of the arum flower and then made experiments and decided that this can be a very ingenious way of reducing the water consumption. And indeed, experimentation showed that it can easily use 2.5 liters per flush versus the traditional 12 liters. So the potential to save water is really, really huge. Okay. And then we have those technologies that are dealing with acid mine drainage, especially in the sense of separating the dissolved metals. And when I tried to compare with existing alternatives, I also realized that there are hardly any alternatives, because when this problem erupted in South Africa, the way they have dealt with it was to just deal with the acidity. So with the lime precipitation to increase the pH of acid mine drainage. But this just results in postponing the problem, but not solving it. You reduce the acidity, but the heavy metals remain dissolved in that water. So these are processes that want to deal with the long-term consequences of acid mine drainage by the devising methods of separating the salts. We will go to maybe to more details with this eutectic freeze crystallization. If we go to the second criteria again, what are the costs? When going to those innovations that serves rural communities, they have been designed with the affordability in mind. So most of them are affordable. And the way that they have been introduced was also based on subsidization of rural communities by the Department of Science and Technologies, currently the Department of Science and Innovation. But you will be surprised that even though they are relatively affordable, the people in rural communities can hardly afford them without the subsidization of the Department of Science and Technology, which is now again the Department of Science and Innovation, or any government office that can support the adoption. We tend to forget that almost 50% of the population here in South Africa live under the threshold of poverty. So things that sometimes seem to be affordable to people who have income are very, very expensive for people living in disadvantaged communities in rural areas without access to safe water. Again, the Safe Water Africa is a project that is financed partly by the European Union, and they are still in the stage of piloting. It's promising, but again, even when the technology gets ready, it's extremely difficult to know how it's going to diffuse to the rural communities that need it, because even the small amounts that are needed to purchase the related equipment can be prohibitively costly for those communities. And the government does not seem to have adequate budgeting to make the financial support that can make those innovations diffuse to all community members that need it. Again, the wave energy reverse osmosis for desalination, its costs are very difficult to estimate because it has also not reached the last stage of technology readiness so that it can be deployed. But it's a very promising technology because it's also being developed in many other parts of the planet. Its advantage being its environmentally friendliness. In the end, when the technology is fully developed, it will be a very, very important source of green energy that can be used, especially in coastal areas in many countries, not just in South Africa, but in Latin America, in Australia, in Asia, to find alternative ways of generating energy, which can subsequently then be used for desalination, but as I said again, to other forms of activities that need green energy. AquaTrip, the cost is known, and the saving that it can generate are really, really big. So this one is quite affordable, and in the final conclusion, this is also one of the reasons why it has been able to diffuse quite largely in South Africa and in Australia. The Arumlu, this microflush toilet, it is offered at a cost of 800 rand. Which is a reasonable price. It's comparable to the prices of other toilets with the same quality, but it's still costly. But then its production has not taken off. So I have not really been able to figure out, other than the constraint of funding, the reason why it is not enthusiastically adopted, given the potential water saving that it promises. The eutectic fish crystallization, this one is very tricky because for a full-scale plant that is capable of generating the types of treatment at a large scale, the required investment is about 20 million. So I spoke with one of the leading scientists who has worked a lot of years together with the teams at the University of Cape Town to develop this technology. And one of the outcomes of our discussion was, whereas developing this technology, you can just attract the research fund over a period of 10 years, which is going to be like maybe 20 to 25 million over 10 years. So it's maybe 2.5 million each year. But for this plant, you need to have the whole sum at once. And it's extremely difficult to have a partner, a funding partner that is ready to disperse 20 million for a prototype. Likewise, for the other processes, the BioShield process, the Aquasoft, and the alternative reverse osmosis for acid mine drainage treatment, it's rather difficult to estimate because they have not reached the full deployment stage. So the funding is still lacking, but they have made some demonstrations that show that the technology is viable. The funding is the biggest constraint. So for the evaluation criteria on compatibility with existing values, I did not find any technology that did clash with existing values, but also the complementary resources. Most of those technologies for rural areas were relatively simple, were welcomed by the communities in places where they have been piloted, and the complementary resources were easily accessible and easy to maintain. Jumping again to eutectic phase crystallization, the big environmental pollution challenge that is in South Africa actually means that the eutectic phase crystallization should be welcomed with open arms. It does not clash with any of the existing values, and it has the potential to solve a big problem that is threatening to actually bury South Africa under a huge amount of pollution. On the score of complexity, the rural innovations are relatively simple, or at least unsophisticated, and they have been explained to rural communities in places where they have been piloted. People have been trained on how to clean and maintain the units, but also how to use the corresponding accessories, including the filters, but also the chemicals. And Safe Water South Africa is the one that is going to use some technologies that are imported from Germany and Spain. And one is a little bit more complex. But again, with the proper training, people can actually learn how to master those technologies, but also to maintain them and keep them operating even when the initial developers of technologies are no longer there. The AquaTrip. It's an electronic system to detect the leaks in the water pipe system. So in itself it's complex, but the device is very easy. So once it is installed, it operates automatically and it is quite effective. So nobody needs to understand the underlying electronic system, the same way that we use mobile phones. Without going to the electronic systems that are underneath, this one can also be easily used. This ARMLU is quite interesting because, as I said earlier, it's just the design. Otherwise, it has been made compatible with the existing plumbing systems that exist in the country, and it can be adapted to any types of downstream system. So its complexity level is relatively low. Again, the technologies for AMD treatment are very complex, but on the other hand, they should be targeted to big corporations, especially mining corporations, but also companies like Eskom that use a lot of water and is capable of generating also pollutant. So those targeted customers have also the capabilities of developing the skills that are necessary to handle those complex technologies. But we need to understand that complexity and costs are the biggest disadvantages of those technologies. The fifth evaluation criteria again, we see that the rural point of use filtration technologies or innovations, they have been presented to communities in forms of piloting trials. So they have been able to try them with the support of funding from the DST. It did not cost them anything. But for the household that were not exposed to the same piloting, either they will have to observe the villages where the piloting has taken place, but the observability is relatively low, or they will have to have the piloting done in their own areas. But the government and the municipalities do not have the budgeting for that. For the wave energy reverse osmosis for desalination, so only there was a piloting that was done, but the innovation has not been tried widely to target customers. AquaTrip, before its widespread adoption, was also piloted, so people have been able to observe its effect. This has helped, and it continues to help. So now it's no longer necessary to try it because now people can observe companies and households that have adopted it and see by themselves the type of benefits that the device is bringing. The complex technologies of acid mine drainage innovations, they are hardly triable, and the observability is also very low. As I said, so far only one plant has been set up at a cost of 20 million. So it's very, very, very difficult to think of triability unless you are really, really ready to put 20 million on the table. So with all of this information, we now have an idea why the diffusion of those innovations has been slow. Access to funding needed to bridge innovation, development, and commercialization has been a very important factor constraining diffusion, especially for those types of innovation that need a lot of for its mass commercialization. The point of use purification innovation present a clear advantage with respect to incumbent alternatives, are relatively easy to use, and were developed with affordability factor in mind. But again, the resources for subsidizing a widespread adoption in rural communities are lacking. That's the biggest constraint. The AquaTrip scored well on most of those criteria. It has also reached the highest level of technology readiness level, which may help explain why it has reached a very sustainable diffusion trajectory. And the tricky one is the Arum Law, at least in my eyes, because for me, the advantages are clear. It has very favorable indicators, but is still awaiting for the required funding to expand production for commercialization. Unfortunately, I have not been able to interview the people who developed this innovation to have more details about the tricky types of constraints. So that will be my next mission. This one is still tricky to me. I need to get additional information about that because it has a very big potential. As for the wastewater and AMD treatment innovation, they have clear advantages over potential alternatives, but they are rather costly. And they still need some technical validation, and some of them are effective in some types of settings, for instance, in relatively low pH environment, and become less effective, especially this biosure process becomes less effective with high levels of concentration of dissolved salts and high levels of acidity. So what can be done? One of the possibilities to overcome those constraints is to institutionalize incubation with adequate scaling up mechanism. And one can take example on the Chinese National Fund for Technology Transfer and Commercialization that has been quite effective in bridging this funding gap that is sometimes referred to as the valley of death. So from the development of validation of an innovation to its full commercialization. And one of the ideas that was suggested is fostering a research industry partnership, especially for those innovations that need a lot of funding, so that trust can be built from the outset, and when the industry and the innovators know that they can work with one another, then it's much easier to develop that relationship and secure funding. Another recommendation is the encouragement of extra-sectoral innovation and diffusion of technology that have a bearing on water innovation value chain. As I said, any types of innovation in mining can also help reduce the type of water use, but also the type of problems that will be generated by the mining when the exploitation ceases. For technologies to diffuse much more widely, it's very important to contribute to increasing awareness regarding their existence and their effectiveness and their advantages. And it's very important that the culture of innovation be disseminated in the country so that people would always be expecting new innovation and be prepared to adopt them. And in cases involving water in rural communities, even when the technologies and innovations have been adopted, it's very, very important to train people for the sustainability of the innovation once the adoption has taken place. And I think that's it, that's the end.
Right. Thank you very much, Alexis, for this very insightful presentation, and indeed tackling a very important topic you know, in the context of the challenges that we're facing in the country on water, particularly as it applies to how people who are located in rural areas can also access clean water for drinking purposes, but also water for sanitation purposes. And we're going to get to the discussion element, and I'm going to ask colleagues to use the raise hand facility of this Zoom system to indicate if you have a comment or you have a question. And I would also encourage colleagues to also use the chat function as well. If you just want to put that question you have in that section, I will be able to read the question. And remember, when you are commenting, please introduce yourself and tell us the organization that you come from. And also don't forget to switch on your video so that we can also see who you are. So I'm going to ask colleagues to start raising hands if you have any comment and or any question that you want to pose to Alexis. And whilst we're waiting for colleagues to raise their hands and make their comments, I would just say and you know, make one or two comments. And from the presentation, Alexis, I'm very happy because there's a set of good news. And in particular, when you're looking at these many innovations that you have analyzed or assessed, there is a sense that one, they are relevant in as far as addressing the key challenges that are affecting our marginalized communities in the rural areas. And that is indeed very good news. And secondly, when one looks at the criteria that you have used, you get a sense that one, most of these innovations are indeed affordable, even though, of course, the issues around the ability of our marginalized communities to still buy these is a challenge. But at least most of them, from your presentation, the suggestion is they could be affordable if there is some level of subsidies from the government. And the big news is that they are also compatible with some of the resources that the people in the rural areas and in the marginalized communities have. So they are able to ideally adopt some of these innovations and use them. I haven't received any hand so far, so I'm not too sure whether colleagues are able to use the raise hand option on Zoom. You just click on participants, and then on the right column, just below the list of the participants, you would see the option. Among others, there will be a raise hand option. So if you have a comment or question, I would encourage you to then press the raise hand. I will see it and then give you the opportunity to comment or raise a question. But to continue with my observations and the set of good news from your presentation, Alexis, I'm also very happy that you found that relatively most of these innovations are not as sophisticated. They can be used by our people who are located in these marginalized contexts. Often they have very low levels of education and are not in a position to handle some of the sophisticated innovations that might be there. So that is indeed some good news. And the word, however, is that when you presenting, and I would want a comment from you, Alexis, to start talking about one, the extent to which these communities were involved in the development or the design and development of some of these innovations, you know, because in the context of inclusive innovation or innovation for inclusive development, it is always important to try and get the opinions and views of some of these would-be beneficiaries on these technologies, as instead, you know, in contrast to trying to go for innovation that be beneficial for them and arguing that they benefit from the outcomes of innovation instead of also these marginalized participating in the process of innovation. That would be my first comment and question. And also, I would want to hear from you, Alexis, having seen the graph that you presented to us with regards to the admirable commitment of government in terms of supporting these innovations in the water sector. We saw what the WRC is doing. And I would want to know if you could comment on the percentage from that amount that you were presenting to us that is dedicated to the aspect of dissemination or transfer of these technologies to the would-be beneficiaries. Is it a case of just overcommitting to the development of the innovation and no budgetary allocation towards making sure that these innovations are then transferred to the locals beyond just piloting? And I would stop here for now, Alexis, and if you make comments with that regard, whilst I'm waiting for other colleagues to make their comments with regards to some of the issues that you raised.
Thank you. Should I respond first before we give the floor to others, or should I wait?
I think you should go ahead because I haven't received any hand. And if colleagues have problems with using the raise a hand function, then they can indicate or they can just jump in. If you can't use the raise a hand, you can just jump in and pose your question. But for now, Alexis, I would say go ahead and answer these questions whilst we're waiting for other colleagues to come in into the conversation.
Okay. Thank you very much. This is an extremely important question because when we talk about inclusive innovation, we tend to conceive it as a kind of external innovation that is going to make people feel included while they have not really been involved in its design and its implementation, and when their views have not been included in the design of the product or in, of the process itself. So very, very important. Regarding these innovations, one interesting innovation that I did, that I have removed from the initial sample, is the one that the Hippo Roller that was designed to help rural communities transport water from the river or from whatever source at a distance and bring it home. As I mentioned earlier, traditional people were capable of maybe transporting 20 liters of water on their head for maybe 5 to 6 kilometers away from their home. And somebody who grew on the farm, a white Afrikaner farmer, when he was observing all of these rural women having to struggle with that problem, just designed this Hippo Roller. On that level, he did not need to go and first consult with them, even though I definitely think that he did. But because he knew the condition, he has been living with that condition. So he knew what the problem was. He came up with an idea of this EPORA. Some of you have definitely heard of it. And it's a tank system that can be rolled, designed in plastic with the handle. And people can actually roll 90 liters of water at the same distance where they used to go and fetch water, but they can just roll it towards their homes and they will not be tired when they arrive home. So it's quicker and faster. But the same cannot be said for most of other innovations. So the Vulaman system was developed by the Department of Science and Technology with the CSIR. The technology that is being used by Safe Water Africa, as I mentioned, is coming from Spain and Germany with the funding from the European Union, is quite effective. It's adapted to the needs of the community. So at the piloting phase, there is definitely a good interaction between the communities and the innovators, so that any adjustment that are necessary can still be made. That's the role of the piloting. Whether people have been involved in design, the design phase, is not necessarily true. But before the technology can be fully deployed, piloting itself is an element of that need and desire to consult so that the product can be adopted before it is brought to the market. So to that extent, most of these technologies have been piloted to collect the views of the involved communities and then adapt to their needs and desires. Except those technologies, as I said, that have not reached the maturation level of 8. So they are still struggling with the validation. And it's only once they have solved all of the validation problems that they will engage with the involved users to make sure that the needs and desires are taken into account. That's what I can say so far. This question, very, very important. What I left out of the presentation is the methodology that I used. So I had gone through interviews, but also desktop review of many Water Research Commission reports. And one of the things that they do, that they are good at, is they have a budget for dissemination, a quite substantial budget, actually. I don't have the percentage right now, but I think it's like 20%. It's quite substantial, I can check. But they pay a lot of attention to the dissemination.
Okay, all right, thanks. Thank you, Alexis. I see three hands. So I would start with Shana, Jay, and then Chijioke. Go for it, Shana.
Hi there, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good stuff. Thanks for the presentation, Alexis. I'm Shana, I'm from the Water Research Commission. So it was interesting to hear your presentation. I've got two clusters of comments that I'd love your thoughts on. Maybe just as context from where I come from, I'm part of the business development and innovations team at the WRC. In this team, we have a range of programs that we operate in collaboration with partners like the Department of Science and Innovation that deal with the upscaling and deployment of technologies in different ways. So one of them you would have picked up in your research is the Water Technologies Demonstration Program. There's also the South African Sanitation Acceleration Program, the SASDEP program that is also in that camp. And I think over the last, I'd say, 5 years, we've learned a lot around, you know, some of these opportunities and barriers around the innovation space. It's also this report that came out of the context of that work that you've been using as your basis. Yeah, no, the two comments, the one was around your set of criteria for evaluating what hinders or enables innovations to the market. And I think they're all important questions, and I mean, certainly questions that we grapple with when we choose to fund technology demonstrations in particular. It's part of how we would do the review process. But one of the things I wanted to say is that it feels to me that there's a need for almost staging in that set of criteria, where things like the advantage of a technology in relation to others, the compatibility of the technology in relation to existing values in a market. These are questions you have to be asking very early on in the development process already. Keep your eye on as the technology starts maturing, but it's not typically things that you're going to ask at the point that you've already got a technology that's immature enough for demonstration. You need to be looking at those things really early on so that you help to accelerate things that really make sense. And so, yeah, the need for phasing before you get to trials or demonstrations is, it's something maybe just to think about with those criteria. And you may have already thought about it, but just not discussed that in the presentation. So that was the one thought I had. The second thing I had is that, I suppose our experience when we've been doing this work around technology upscaling and deployment is that kind of all of the usual literature and stuff, although it gives you high-level guidelines, it's often in the detail that you start finding the real barriers and the kind of nuancing between the innovations. And I mean, just a couple of things, and there's many more that we could add that just jumped to mind while you were talking. The one is that we can't make a blanket assumption that it's always a public sector funder that needs to be driving these innovations. You need to quite carefully nuance when you've got a public sector technology opportunity and when you've got a private sector opportunity. And with some of those technologies on your list, they belong in different parts of the market. And that's the one thing. The second thing is when you are talking about something that is ultimately best fitted to a public market, it's a very complex set of things that in my view is not so much about a lack of funds, but more around a set of constraints in terms of the rules of the system, how municipalities and water boards, for example, are understanding the rules around single source procurement and the limitations that you have when you've got an emerging or a new technology on the market. Institutional cultures around risk aversion, the fact that we often go to solutions that we've tried before rather than things that are new. Things like that are some of the real detailed, tricky things to dig into in the public space, you know, that we've been picking up. Another thing is to just, I think, be mindful of how low the price of water is and how that's often a driver and a constraint around the market for things, particularly when you've got private consumers that might be buying the technologies. And the last two thoughts I had was, you picked up on some of these nuances when you were talking about Aramlu, but there's a way to walk still in terms of industrializing the water sector, in terms of our manufacturing capability, our ability to produce molds and manufacture locally. We've made some progress in terms of enshrining water as its own sector in the industrial policy action plan over the last few years. But I think, again, there's a way to walk there, and it's much more nuanced than just funding, but actually developing an industrialized, standalone, influential sector. And I think we've still got a way to go around the national system of innovation institutions and the ability we have to hand over innovations to new clusters of funders as the development path occurs. So often you're finding that innovators are having to kind of start from scratch every time they move to a different funder because the institutions themselves, given the kind of, I suppose, policy constraints they have around implementation, can't just motivate for a handover into a higher level of funding for a later technology readiness level. And so I think there's a system maturity and synergizing that is also part of the detailed devils that we're dealing with. So just some thoughts that I thought I'd throw into the pot. Thank you.
Thanks, Shana, for those insightful thoughts. Jay, go ahead.
Okay, so sorry, I'm just trying to get my video working. And thank you for Alexis for tackling a very exciting and stimulating area. We sleep and dream about this every day, of how we create this diffusion. So it would have been good if you had spoken to us. We would have given you some much harder and larger objectives, to also clear our minds up. Because this diffusion, and Shana's given some good riders around some of the constraints we live in the modern world. And one of it is called technology lock-in, and you cannot do diffusion where everything's locked in. That's the first thing. The second thing is that a lot of the WRC work is aligned to solving problems in the larger public sector. We're not doing any kind of big ticket items that drive the private sector or the commercial or the industrial sector. So whatever list is there is guided towards solving social, country-related challenges, etc., and largely public-driven elements, etc. So the element of lock-in is something that a lot of the textbooks around diffusion don't talk about. A lot of the theory around diffusion comes from the more modern technology world of IT and IT products and those kind of stuff. It's not in the areas that we work with. So somebody put a comment, was the communities consulted about the technology? So that's a paradigm we've been locked in for too long, that if you design something, they have to accept it. Rather than saying, let's understand the psychology there and give them something aspirational. You understand the difference. So we take a very ugly standpipe and we put it in a community. Okay. Whereas we're not innovating and saying, let's give an aspirational standpipe that people would appreciate and look after, etc. So that's the first point. The second point is, a lot of the innovations that we develop just don't come from, it's years of strategy and understanding and et cetera on what areas we need to drive. So for example, the Aramlu comes from a very long strategic disruptive technology that why should we be flushing with 9 liters of water? And it's very disruptive. And it's disrupting thinking in the engineering sector and the market and the industrial sector. Because now somebody is sitting there and they've laced up the whole standards environment and the regulatory environment to make sure their 9 liter flush toilet gets priority in the procurement and application. Mm-hmm. Here you're sitting with a 2 liter innovation which cannot get absorbed by government because they have all these barriers. So it's what Shana said, is that we need to open up those barriers through markets and industrial processes that allow these technologies to grow and be available and get diffused. So I'm glad you took the example of the Hippo roller as an example. The Hippo roller's diffusion wasn't about the technology. It was somebody's smart idea to make it a charity program. Okay. And get the private sector to pay for it so that they could do large numbers. So the Hippo roller and the what you call the roundabout pump, etc., were nothing novel. We just had a good business model around them. So in this diffusion aspect, which I missed, is that looking at, so the Vula Manji is a good example, okay? And sometimes you have to step back far in history. We have one of the biggest contributions to mankind that has come out of South Africa and the WRC. Okay, and it's a crazy diffusion model if you understand it. It's called biological nutrient removal, or what we call activated sludge. Okay, came from our backyard. Today, it contributes to mankind and public health in terms of treating all the sewage and wastewater in the developed world. And the developing world, okay? And it was a diffusion model. We decided at that time that it should be in the public domain for it to leap into its innovation pathways and application. And that was the strategy. It wasn't all commercial. We should have commercialized it. The story would have been very different. So you always have to weigh this down around saying that, you know, which is the best diffusion pathway, you know, and where would you get the maximum? Is it sitting on the product or is it sitting on the offering? You know, and lots of people, I mean, if you study the iPad's diffusion model, it was all on the offering, not on the product. They made no money on the product. The money was being made on the software and all the platforms that draw you into chewing data and convenience and adverts and all that kind of stuff. So designing the diffusion pathway is something, you know, that's really needs to go, more thinking needs to go in. And that's what we're learning from the water sector, because we have all these lock-ins, okay, that people, and we're not offering the value add. We're selling a product. You know, we're going to somebody and saying, here is a 2-liter toilet. You know, who cares? You know, no one cares. But we need to turn the language to say, this is an aspirational toilet that brings your contribution to climate change. And maybe people will listen because people are becoming more attuned. You know, so it's that kind of psychology that we need to bring in the new diffusion model. And the other thing is also finding the diffusion model that disrupts the public sector environment, because we tend to lock ourselves in to say, you know, local government must buy this. I mean, we know how local government works. You know? So you have to disrupt that space and put the power back in the hands of the individual. And you see a lot of the technologies like the Vula Manzi, et cetera, is putting that power in the hands of the householder and saying, you don't have to depend on the local government to buy this. We're trying to make it aspirational and affordable that you can buy it yourself and you get the benefit on your own. And you have a market that provides the service, the support, and whatever that goes with it. So I think this is what I missed in the kind of whole diffusion thing, to say that, you know, you got to take it into the context that, you know, in Africa, we have an African challenge. You know, in the developing world, we have a developing challenge, and we need to have the right nuances around the markets and understanding of how you stimulate the diffusion, you know, around these innovations. And I'm not saying it's easy. You know, I can't say that we've been all that greatly successful, but I can tell you we're making an impact in a small way. Hopefully once it gets to the tipping point, it'll sort of escalate in its own way.
All right, thanks very much, Jay. Chijioke, go for it briefly before we get Alexis to respond. We are running out of time, so colleagues, just try and keep it as brief as possible. Thank you. Chijioke, go ahead, please.
Sorry, I didn't know my thing was muted. Thank you, Alexis, and given the time, I wouldn't have to say much, but the point I wanted to reiterate was the, you know, in terms of the diffusion, talking about something that's, you know, important as this, I'm just hearing about this innovation for the first time. I'm not the most, I don't think I'm the most ignorant person out there, but if it's just this way, so you can imagine the general population. So my point is that school raised an issue, a question about the proportion of the budget of the WROC devoted to diffusion. And Alexis said maybe it's about 20%. I think the problem may not be about the money. I think the next question we must ask is what is being done with the budget? So it's not a public sector thing that we say, you must spend this amount of money in a year for this sort of thing. If not, you lose money. You know, you lose allocation. I think the more important question is what is being done with it. You know, and also another thing I'm asking is what is the level of synergy and collaboration between those responsible to, you know, for these innovations and the end users. So, you know, you talk about your real estate, you know, in the people who are involved in the real estate, whatever their associations, whatever their bodies are, who are really constructing new apartments. And Alexis made the point, for instance, that flushing is one of the most water intensive, you know, activities in the home. How are you getting to them? How are these organizations responsible, or the innovators? What is the bridge between them and the end users? Because I'm sure that most domestic people don't even know about these innovations. You know, just so those are my sort of questions I'm asking. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Chichioka. Alexis, you have a few minutes to make comments. And if colleagues have other pending questions that they have, I would encourage you to just put them on the chat, and Alexis will respond in the next 3 minutes and touch on other issues as they might be added on our group chat. Alexis, please go ahead.
Okay. First of all, I have to apologize because my connection was cut while Shana was speaking, but I had been able to catch what she was saying. So I missed part of Jay's remarks. I'm trying to react to those comments very briefly. First of all, I really want to thank you very much, three of you, for these inspiring comments. Taking public sector as actually the main driver of innovation, it's a very, very valid point. I did not really go to the details of the research because of time constraint, obviously. But in one of my graphs, I showed the part of the funding that comes from the private sector and the part that comes from the public sector. And there is a substantial amount of funding that is coming from the private sector for water innovation. It's actually higher than the public sources. So it's a very valid point that we need to harness the synergies between the private and the public sector when it comes to innovation in general, and this one also in particular. When it comes to supporting innovation, the innovators that I have been able to speak with were very, very speaking of the Water Research Commission in a lauding way, actually. The Water Commission has been extremely helpful in listening to the needs of the innovators of any kind and being attentive to their ideas. They have really been able to give the type of support that was required, and people continue to praise the way that the Water Research Commission is involved in stimulating innovation. So it's a very important thing to mention. So also to Shana, because she comes from there. So now, very briefly to Jay's remark, very, very valid point indeed. The diffusion models are very important. And the choices that the innovators made, whether to go for commercial or whether to go for the benefits to humanity. But again, I just want to refer to this article by Bronwyn Hall and Kahn in 2003. When people design innovation, they need to understand that it's not the innovation that is going to change. It's diffusion. So diffusion should be on the mind, even though we understand that there is a drive to bring those benefits to people, should the innovators should have on their mind, how is that thing going to diffuse? and how are we going to secure the support and the resources necessary for the technology or the innovation of any type or the process to diffuse. Most of them do it, experience that I have had with this, by relying on governmental organization. So some of these innovations have actually been diffused through the NGO system, which is based on some kind of voluntary contribution. But in the end, that well-intended strategy can actually put limits on what the good innovation can achieve in the end. Because if you reach a few people, or will get it for free, but if it does not reach a majority, the benefits will remain limited. So it's a balance between, let's say, the good intentions of free public good from innovation and the potential to reach a large number of people and deliver on the benefits. And Tijoki's remark also very, very important on what is done with the budget. Quite interesting question. But again, my experience is that the Water Research Commission has been quite in generating information and organizing seminars. But that's a question that we will probably have to ask them further. How do they target the audience, and whether they have the impression that the information is getting to all targeted and potential beneficiaries of information in the public at large? But the approach has been very proactive so far. The last point that I want to react on, again, the point back to the point made by Shana, the manufacturing capability, very, very important. And this is why one of the criteria was also the complementarity with existing resources and skills and competences and technologies. Maybe I did not go to the full length of the criterion. It's a very, very important point to know that it's not just about funding. It's also the existence of all of the processes and resources that enable the innovation to be realized and to be integrated in the existing system and then to diffuse. I don't know whether I have responded to the points. Otherwise, you can.
Yes, you can. Alexis, just one last one on the chats from Jamel.
The one on?
On the group chat. On the issue of dissolved salts that remain in solution after some water has been treated. And the question is, are there any innovators that are looking at innovations to remove some of these salts that might have that might remain in the solution?
Okay, can we again?
You can press chat on your Zoom, and you will see the comment that I'm talking about. Just briefly.
Okay. Yes. So, dissolved salts remain in the solution after AMD was treated. Are there any innovators looking? Yes. Okay. I mentioned a series of innovations that have been designed to address this issue. So the BioSure process that was mentioned is designed to use biological processes to remove those salt from acid mine drainage. The Aquasoft, the same. And the eutectic freeze crystallization, which is this expensive technology, but its main target is actually it uses a process that is called eutectic freeze, which is based on the property of salt dissolved in liquid to if the cool, let's say if the cooling is done according to the eutectic properties, each salt having its own eutectic point, it means that the salts can crystallize it at its own point, so that each salt can actually be removed from the water, and the water will just remain ice. And when ice is formed from water, expel all the impurities, which are those salts. Eutectic freeze crystallization is specifically designed to deal with the problem of acid mine drainage. Another technology that is being used, so, but that's the old one, is the traditional reverse osmosis, which uses a lot of energy and pressure to push the water with dissolved salts through very, very fine membranes, and then the salt will remain on the one side and the water will be pressed on the other side. The same process that is used for desalination can also be used for acid mine drainage, but it's very expensive, it devotes a lot of energy. So one of the properties of eutectic freeze crystallization is also based on the fact that the energy of freezing is much lower than the energy that will be used in desalination, or the energy that can be used if you want to take it through the evaporation. So evaporation will be one of the methods. You evaporate all the water, the salt will remain on the bottom. And that would consume a lot of energy. So the EFC solves that problem because of the lower energy that is needed through the freezing.
All right, thank you very much, Alexis, and thank you very much, everyone, for participating in this webinar. We appreciate you taking your time to come and listen and contribute to this discussion on water innovation in South Africa.